like to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, I may, 3 minutes.
Would you say 3 minutes?
Yes, sir.
All right. You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Good day, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Ron Herr with the Office of the Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Ms. Lauren Smith, defendant in the Circuit Court of Spotsylvania. Your Honors, Ms. Smith was convicted of a voluntary manslaughter charge and sentenced to 10 years of incarceration. The issues before the court fall largely in two rubrics. Number one, sufficiency of the evidence, and number two, mental health concerns, being whether or not she was competent, whether or not she knowingly, intelligently waived her presence at trial, and other issues along those lines. Focusing on the sufficiency of the evidence,
Let me interrupt you, yes, if I can, on that point. It seems to me it really comes down. The options here are, you know, she gave her version of the events, which, if believed, would have resulted in probably a conviction for involuntary manslaughter. We have the Commonwealth's version, or the light most favorable Commonwealth, which would have resulted in the verdict of either second-degree murder or voluntary manslaughter. In this case, it actually resulted in voluntary manslaughter verdict. And our role here is there evidence in the record to support the verdict, each element of the verdict with voluntary manslaughter, which only requires, common law crime only requires an intentional killing, you know, without malice. And her statement is, you know, I shot him, I thought the gun was empty, I pointed at him and squeezed the trigger. So if the fact finder discounted the fact that she knew it was empty, which they're free to do, they could pick and choose what they want to believe from a witness, then from a sufficiency standpoint, now the competency issue is a little different, but from a sufficiency standpoint, why isn't that sufficient to establish voluntary manslaughter?
Yeah, because in order to get from second degree to voluntary manslaughter, the court is required, or the evidence...
Well, the difference is malice.
The difference is malice, exactly. Malice is abrogated by heat of passion. And when the court has... And this is where the jury instruction issue kind of falls into play, I guess, with what Mr. Ahmed had previously put forward. If the jury instruction for voluntary manslaughter in this case, if I may pause, had not been granted, and the Commonwealth had objected, and of course the only scintilla of evidence to support a heat of passion argument would be the argument regarding the presence of a gun, the trial court would be well in sitting there and rejecting our request for that jury instruction. And if I came before this court seeking succor for that jury instruction to be having been provided, this court would also probably turn me down, because this court has said words are never sufficient alone. No matter how vile or contemptuous, words are not sufficient to convert or to even merit the instruction being given. So if words are insufficient to merit the instruction being even given, how is it possible then to sit there and say it's sufficient to support a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt? The argument is not the fact that there is something in the record saying that there is no feasible way in which the jury could have gotten to voluntary manslaughter, because it's not possible. If this court affirms the conviction on voluntary manslaughter, it sends a message to the defense bar. If you have an argument, by the way, no matter how slight, and here's the reason why, Your Honor, when we consider the heat of passion, we have always looked toward the nature and degree of that, which is provocation. The provocation here was you can't take care of your gun properly. It wasn't something along the lines of marital infidelity. It wasn't actually a knife being brandished. It's simply words.
I'm struggling to understand why we're talking about heat of passion. This is the verdict for voluntary manslaughter, which does heat of passion is irrelevant to that.
Well, it abrogates malice. That's the reason why.
Yeah, but all we're talking about is an intentional killing. No question there's a death. There's no question your client is the agent of that death. So the only issue is there any evidence of an intent to kill, if you will? She admitted she pointed the gun at her husband and squeezed the trigger.
I may be mistaken, Your Honor, because it's my understanding voluntary manslaughter is not simply an intentional killing, but it's intentional killing committed while in the sudden heat of passion upon reasonable provocation.
That's one form of it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Certainly, because the heat of passion is what negates the malice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Without the heat of passion argument, but you can have, you know, assuming hypothetically that the Commonwealth charged second-degree murder, and simply in the judgment of the fact finder found the evidence insufficient to a reasonable doubt to establish malice, But everything else, then you've got a voluntary manslaughter verdict, irrespective of whether there's any evidence of heat of passion. It's just in this case, there was some evidence of heat of passion. So from a, you know, apples and oranges, I guess, we're talking about whether in this case the evidence was sufficient for the elements of voluntary manslaughter, of which there are only two.
Your Honor, forgive me, I may be confused and mistaken. Also, I will refer the court to one thing. Regarding the issue of it, because the court said it's intentional killing in the absence of malice. The court, during Joint Appendix page 1531, in discussing the motion to set aside the conviction, actually pointed to the fact that the Commonwealth and the defendant's version of facts were competing, and that the finder of fact made the decision determination as to what had happened, and said that there was an intentional act, but not an intentional killing. So if the court says that there's no intentional killing, I failed to see. And that's why the motion to set aside was denied. It might be feasible then that the trial court had applied the wrong standard, and maybe a consideration or a reconsideration would be appropriate.
Can I ask you on this, though? Why doesn't, if the thought is, okay, words alone are not enough, and we have a case that seems to say that, why doesn't the Supreme Court's decision in Blankenship, given the shooting that occurred here and the malice, why isn't there enough evidence for second-degree murder, and therefore because there was a conviction of a lesser offense and no prejudice to defendant if she was convicted of a lesser offense, why wouldn't Blankenship govern this?
Blankenship, honestly, Your Honor, is unique and it's odd. The standard of Blankenship, here's the reason
why. We've had other cases since Blankenship that cite to
And I understand. But it says if the evidence demands or warrants a conviction on the higher charge, and here's, again, I go back to 1531. The jury was able to see and hear the witnesses, which this court has always said, an appellate court does not second-guess the finder of fact. It does not sit as a super jury.
That's right.
This jury heard the evidence and didn't find that there was second-degree murder.
Well, we have lots of case law, as you know, Mr. Herr, that says juries can show mercy and juries don't have to... juries don't explain why they've done what they've done.
And that's understandable, Your Honor. I understand that wholeheartedly. But the other concern is that Blankenship cites the Burton and Conquest, where Judge, I believe, Keith, and they use the word Judge Keith, I don't mean any disrespect to Judge or Justice, unless this practical application of law was upheld owing to the tenderness of juries and their reluctance to impose a higher penalty, many crimes would go wholly unpunished, and thus the rigor of the law would tend rather to the promotion rather than prevention of crime. We're not asking that this matter be acquittal and dismiss. The distinction Mr. Ahmed raises is purely voluntary versus involuntary. I'm not asking something along the lines of aggravated or malicious wounding down to unlawful, which is a completely different range of punishment. Voluntary and involuntary manslaughter, 18.235 and 36, are both the exact same class 5 penalty with the same range of punishment. The focus is on legally what is the appropriate conviction. What is the appropriate legal charge she should be convicted of? We're not complaining as to the fact that it's not as if I'm asking for something less, maybe a class 6 felony. It's not that's not the situation before the court. It's the same range of punishment.
I guess if I got to come back to my question. If the evidence is enough for a conviction for second degree murder, and the Supreme Court in Blankenship has said it's enough for that. In Blankenship, I think it was involuntary manslaughter was the one that it was that they based it on. But here, I mean, both voluntary and involuntary are lesser homicide offenses than second degree murder. So why wouldn't Blankenship resolve this and allow the jury and to do what it did and the Judge Denneke to allow it to stand?
Because there's a difference between flat-out dismissal of an involuntary manslaughter conviction, Your Honors, as opposed to asking for a similar charge with the same exact range of punishment. We're not asking for flat-out dismissal. It's the same exact charge. The prejudice would, of course, be what you're ultimately convicted of. Are you convicted of involuntarily killing an individual, or are you convicted of voluntary manslaughter? That is the prejudice. I believe prejudice could be found in many ways and respects, such as if the court looks toward the pre-indictment delay or speedy trial. concerns as to what you're ultimately under or what you're subjected or accused of doing can cause anxiety. What you're convicted of, if you're wrongfully convicted, can cause similarly that anxiety and prejudice to an individual.
Can I ask you about, I don't recall how much time you deserve for rebuttal, but I wanted to get to this point before you get into your rebuttal time. With respect to the competency issue, here your client expressly asked to be excused from court, during portions of the trial. The trial court explained that she had a right to be present, and she indicated she understood that. The presumption, of course, is that you are competent to stand trial. No one, especially, and I don't know if you were trial counsel or not, but the trial counsel did not raise the issue of competency at any point prior to trial, nor, in fact, did they raise it at the point when she asked to be excused. So it seems to me the trial court concluded that she made a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent decision to waive her right to be present during portions of the trial. Now it's alleged for the first time on appeal, essentially, that was error because she wasn't competent to make that decision. What can we point to into the record that would suggest that is the case when the trial court hadn't put on notice of that at all?
Your Honors, I can only point to the argument presented in the petition. I understand factual findings or otherwise.
I just want to make sure I wasn't missing something.
Your Honor,
kind of straightforward. Whenever I think something's straightforward, it usually turns out to be more complicated than I thought it was. So.
I believe that there are still plausible arguments that were presented in the brief, specifically in Drope versus in the Supreme Court case of Drope, at which point the trial began. And as this court knows, competency is a fluid concept. You can be competent at the start of a trial, but competency can degrade. In Drope, it was a little bit extreme. Mid-trial.
The question is whether she made a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent decision to say, I wish not to be present during portions of these emotionally trying for me portions of the trial.
And I don't, well, Your Honor, if her delivery, respectfully, was just as this court had put it, then I would have no legs to stand on. But the record is replete with evidence as to the fact. In fact, on day two of the trial, I believe, trial counsel asked the court to briefly continue the matter as a psychiatrist was coming the next day to assess her mental health concerns. So there were things in the record that would sufficiently point to the fact that there were mental health concerns. I understand, in fact, that there are certain times that trial counsel said, I'm not raising competency concerns at that point, but that does not preclude the fact that counsel could not later argue competency at a different point. I see that I'm going into my rebuttal time, Your Honor, if I could. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herr. Good afternoon, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Pressing around my fingers.
That's all right. Take your time.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson here for the Commonwealth. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, the Commonwealth's position is that there was evidence in the record from which the jury could find that there was heat of passion in this case. The jury was not required to accept Ms. Smith's theory that this altercation with her husband right prior to the shooting was only words, that it was insignificant. The jury could give that evidence such weight as it thought was appropriate.
Here, so even if it was yelling, screaming, as there was some testimony, including by the children, sadly enough,
yes,
before this all happened, that those are more than words.
I think that it could have been that the jury found that, well, I have two answers for that. I think that it could have been that the jury found that it had to be more severe than that. Also, I think that this is a little similar to the inconsistent verdict cases that we have, where kind of some of the older cases say you just don't know whose ox got gored. So we don't look behind the jury verdict.
Decisions.
Right. We just don't look behind the jury verdict. And I think that's kind
that
of similar.
That goes along with more the blankenship.
Yes, Your Honor, it does. Because, you know, something that kind of puzzles me about the defendant's position is that if we don't have evidence of heat of passion upon reasonable provocation, that doesn't really lower the charge down to involuntary manslaughter. The absence of heat of passion and reasonable provocation in a homicide case means that you're back up to malice in a second-degree murder case or a second-degree murder charge.
You would agree heat of passion is not a common law element of voluntary manslaughter.
No, Your Honor. It's just the absence of malice.
It's a legal concept that can reduce
that's one way to mean it.
To a lesser charge of manslaughter by negating the required element of malice.
Yes, Your Honor. And I did not express that very well in my brief, I don't believe. So I apologize. But yes, Your Honor, that is one way in which malice can be negated. But if the jury can just find that there flat isn't any malice, and I think that's likely what the jury did here for whatever reason, and we don't know because we don't look behind those jury verdicts. As far as the intentional shooting, Your Honor, there was a lot of evidence in this case that was an intentional shooting. We had the firearms people come in and do a demonstration with the gun and explain that it took 10 pounds of pressure to squeeze that trigger. We had the fact that Ms. Smith had taken a firearm safety course and had gotten a concealed weapons permit and knew something about the operation of a firearm. You know, we have Ms. Smith's own words during her interviews saying, you know, she gave a lot of different explanations as to what happened. But at one point she said, oh, well, I didn't point it at my husband. I pointed at the window that he was standing in front of. I mean, I think that the jury can take that those words and kind of give them the weight that they deserve. A jury doesn't have to accept all of the evidence. It doesn't have to accept the evidence in toto. It can give different weight to different parts of the evidence. So I submit the evidence was sufficient to support the conviction of voluntary manslaughter. And I'm happy to answer any other
questions. What about
yes, Your Honor.
The six bullets, she counted four, and then there was one left in the magazine or something, but that left one bullet still.
It left one bullet still, and at one point, Ms. Smith told the officer, I always count my bullets, but I didn't that night. And I think that's a statement from which the jury could certainly, you know, give some weight to that.
That there was malice.
That there was malice, or, and also malice is presumed when someone uses a deadly weapon.
Well, it's not presumed.
Well, it's not presumed. It can be inferred. I'm sorry. Thank you. Sloppy language.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for fixing that. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor. Slip of the mouth there. But here, you know, there was a lot of evidence that the jury could have gone either way. You know, I submit that there was evidence from which the jury could even find first degree, but the jury didn't. And that's the jury's function. The jury is the fact finder. The jury found the facts in this case, and they determined that this was a voluntary manslaughter. And I think there's certainly factual support for that. And I believe that the Blankenship case does cut against, you know, it's an old case, it's a little different case, but I submit that it does cut against
relief in this case. It was applied by this court in Curtley.
Yes, which is fairly recent.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Judge Koontz.
Yes.
Justice Koontz.
When he was Judge Koontz, I guess. But I think that that's a reasonable application of that law. I'm happy to move to the competency issue, or I can answer more questions about sufficiency. Next, we have competency. And in all candor with the court, the defendant did raise the competency issue in one of their post-trial motions. However, they did not raise it in the trial court, kind of when the court had time to could address it, you know, before the conviction. Instead, the objection during the trial itself, and that argument in the post-trial motion is at Appendix 146. But what they argued actually during the trial, when the court could have done something about this was not a voluntary waiver of rights. They made due process objections that it was a voluntary waiver of rights because the defendant was overwhelmed.
Well, competency in this context is, can a defendant understand what
yes.
the proceedings are about? Can they assist their attorney mm-hmm. in the presentation of any defense?
And that wasn't joined. That issue wasn't really litigated, I don't think. In fact, there's several times in the record where counsel says, you know, it's not that she can't help us, it's that she can't waive her rights because she's so upset. Her will is overborne. And I submit that the trial court was in the best place, it was in the best position to judge that. The trial judge was there. The trial judge was meticulous about this defendant's right to a fair trial.
Well, if the allegation is one's will was overborne, that suggests coercion of some sort by some entity.
And there was no coercion by any governmental entity.
She's the one who suggested absenting herself from
yes.
the trial.
And I think that the theory is that her PTSD flashbacks overwhelmed her free will. But that's just not borne out by the record. Even the defendant's expert witness who came in, Dr. Williams, who described how she would help the defendant when she was having one of these dissociative flashbacks, described how she would give her some time, let her calm down, let her ground herself in the present, I believe is the phrase that she used. And when we look at the record, that's exactly what the trial court did. The trial court, you know, Ms. Smith would be upset. She would say, please, please, please don't make me sit here. And the court would say, this is an important right that you have. Step out, talk to your attorneys, and come back when you're more calm, and then we'll talk about it. And after absenting herself from the trial and calming down and consulting with her counsel, Ms. Smith was able to articulate to the court exactly what she wanted to do and why she wanted to do it. And I submit that is a voluntary and knowing waiver.
What about when she indicated she was having chest pains and her chest is hurting? Now, she also said that, I watched the video, the police interview, and she at one point sort of grabbed her chest and said, and it seemed to be quite genuine,
yeah.
My chest really hurts. And you have from the transcript at trial that she indicated her head hurt and her chest was hurting. How do you respond to whether she was under some sort of, physical inability to continue, but yet she had to, even though the judge, as you say, gave her a break each time?
Sure. Well, I think that the defendant made her choice. She said that she had chest pains and her head hurt and, she was having this terrible anxiety, sweaty palms and everything. I think that she was given an opportunity to remove herself from the situation that was causing that anxiety or PTSD, or I don't know the right term because I'm a lawyer and not a doctor, but she was having these incidents and these physical symptoms. The court gave her time to remove herself from that environment, calm down, have time, which is exactly what Dr. Williams described as the procedure, and then she could refocus. Unless I missed something in the record, which I don't think I did, there's not an allegation that Ms. Smith was having this problem at the time, that she was having the chest pains and headache and whatnot at the time she did her waiver, at the time of those colloquies. It appears from the record and from the trial court's finding, and the trial court was there and could look at her and, was in the best position to see what was going on, that she was lucid and calm and could communicate with the court and describe what she wanted to do and make a knowing decision for both her presence in the courtroom and her whether she was going to testify. As to her right to testify, she said that she was afraid that she'd become overwhelmed and wouldn't be able to talk and have to be confronted with the evidence. And those all seem like very reasonable concerns to a defendant facing this kind of charge. And does not appear to be something involuntary. Rather, it seems to be she's making a voluntary reasoned decision. Finally, just very briefly, as to the motion to pause argument, the trial court didn't abuse its discretion when it denied that motion. The best that the defense counsel could come up with was to talk to Dr. Williams to see if that might help. That really didn't place a duty on the trial court to pause the proceedings or continue the proceedings at that point. Furthermore, Dr. Williams was a subpoenaed defense witness, and so there was some issues with that as well. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them, but if not, I'll ask that you affirm.
Any questions?
Thank you so much.
Mr. Herr, you have your rebuttal time.
Your Honors, Commonwealth points to the fact that there's evidence of heat of passion, yelling and screaming, and that the jury could have engaged in disbelieving Ms. Smith. The problem is, if you disbelieve Ms. Smith, then what you have is simply yelling and screaming, no evidence, no physical evidence after being checked by EMS of anything along the lines of bruising or other matters that would suggest a physical altercation. So I would suggest there's no evidence sufficient for heat of passion. Kamal said that there's evidence possibly even a first degree. I believe the court actually struck the first degree, and so therefore the charge went to the jury only as a second, and thereon from that point forward. Simply knowing something about the operation of firearms, I believe, Judge Beals, you mentioned the gun. Her statement to law enforcement was she removed the magazine, discharged the bullet that was there, and then went to her husband. Thing is that the reason why we point to the bullet being on the cabinet top is that it's not possible for simply a bullet to randomly land there, someone would have to remove the bullet from the gun and place it there, which is the physical evidence is in line with her statement of facts. It's not contrary. It actually supports and corroborates what she's saying. Regarding the issue of calming down, going to the competency prong, I know it's a difficult road to hoe. I'm not contesting that issue. But if the entire proceeding needs to be halted for her to gather herself and then calm down and speak to her attorney, she knows, at the very least in her mind, going through a flight and fight response, going through anxiety, PTSD, whatever the case may be, she knows that not being there when the evidence happens is what is going to keep her calm. She knows that her trigger is having to relive the evidence, re-watch the video, and relive the offense of that night. It is a little bit odd to sit there and say, if my ultimate desire is to get out of the courtroom because I can't take it, that I'm in a position to be competent to assist my attorneys in the defense of my tribe. It just seems a little bit inconsistent. I know that the argument was not raised, Your Honor, and I'm not saying that it was. And I know that it's difficult because, again, findings of fact which are voluntariness are binding on the appellate court unless without evidence to support it. But I would suggest that the voluntary manslaughter charge is not correct. It should be involuntary, and the case should be remanded for purposes of trial in that regard. At the very least, the competency issue also should be considered. For those reasons, we ask the court to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Hurley. We will greet counsel, and then the next case on the docket is Hubbard versus Hubbard.